From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Alexis, codenamed Doc Holliday Jackson. Most importantly, you are you. You are here, and that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. And last week, we took a little bit of a break, and in place of our strange news and listener mail segments, we published some classic episodes. We hope you enjoy them, and we are back in the game. The news is going crazy. We do want to touch on several stories that are still developing and will probably end up being future episodes. Spoiler alert, when you hear the news about Kazakhstan and Russia, ask yourself where the world's uranium comes from. 46% of it comes from Kazakhstan. And some sources that have to remain anonymous have told me some stuff that's pretty eye-opening. But we'll get to that later. Yep. Yeah, for
also
now.
Also, a lot of petroleum produced there in Kazakhstan.
Oh, yes. Oh, quite a bit. And for now, we're going to explore some stories about the future of farts, the rise of the pig-hearted, and a terrifying illness that is going through Canada. And this is something that a couple of folks had written to us or to me about in the past, but it's definitely a story that we have our eyes on. Also, you know, before we begin, guys, this is one of the first times I thought the pandemic's really working for me, because everybody, a lot of us are working from home now, and we don't have to deal with the horrific Atlanta traffic that occurs whenever a president rolls through town. Like, this is the first time in my life I've thought, oh, okay, well, I hope everyone has a good time instead of being stuck in Buckhead for 2 hours.
Yeah, as we record this, the current President Biden is speaking right now. Somewhere in our city.
About the urgent need for legislation, which is way different from saying, I'm going to do something.
You need a lot of that. It's crazy. Speaking of traffic, did you guys hear about the traffic jams in, I believe, New York on I-95 that were so bad during those storms that, like, people got stuck with, like, $600 Uber bills?
Oh, yeah, and Virginia is bad.
That's what it was. Where they were shut down. And I'm still wondering why there weren't immediately mobile shelters built. You know what I mean? Like FEMA coming in through with some kind of Uncle Sam version of a yurt.
It's a good question, but apparently a lot of the news crews and helicopters that were shooting the whole thing didn't shy away from filming people getting out of their cars and dropping trow and using the restroom.
Mm-hmm. Oh, gotta well, I mean, if it... machine. If it pees, it leads. No, if it,
no, no, you're there. Quite,
yeah. Okay, right.
if it lacks speed, it leads.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
Traffic jam. Mm-hmm. Never mind. We're all.
If it not if speeds,
if it poops, it's a scoop. Right.
That's the one.
CNN. All right. Sorry. Yeah, but I think we all talked maybe with our colleagues or maybe separately off air about this first story in this week's segment, which is an illness story, and it does not appear to be COVID, right? There's a mystery afoot.
Yes, very much so, and very much not COVID. This is a neurological degenerative disease of some sort or multiple diseases, and it's in a fairly small cluster of 48 people. And you may think, why are you talking about something that's only affecting 48 people on this planet where there's tons of things affecting way more people? Well, because it's puzzling. It's very frightening when you look at the symptoms that are being described and what these 48 people are dealing with. So that's why we're covering it today. And to talk about it, first, we have to travel just northeast of Maine into Canada, into New Brunswick. That is where this cluster of 48 individuals live. And that's where something is affecting people of various ages. It's especially frightening, by the way, because this, whatever this disease is, whatever this thing is, it's affecting young people, with an intense neurodegenerative disease. And to begin, we're going to jump to The Guardian and read the story. Whistleblower warns baffling illness affects growing number of young adults in Canadian province. It was published on January 2nd, and it was written by Leland Secco. Okay, so I think the first thing I want to start with, I've kind of said some of the main points here, is 48 individuals. It was announced in the spring of last year, little less than a year ago, when this cluster of people were announced. And the reason why the word whistleblower is in there is because someone has come forward to state that this is way bigger of a problem than the reaction that it's receiving from officials in New Brunswick, in Canada, and just the medical community, essentially. Let's talk about some of the people and what's happening to them. If you read that article, you will read about a suspected case that would be within this cluster of a man who is developing, you know, what you would consider dementia and a few other symptoms. His wife was taking care of him. She was his caregiver as he was, you know, going through this degeneration. And suddenly she began experiencing strange symptoms, losing sleep, muscle wasting, which you can imagine that, muscles breaking down, dementia and hallucinations herself. And at the time that this article was written, the wife was experiencing worse symptoms than the husband, the person for whom she was caring. And, you know, that's pretty scary, right? Does that mean you think about those two cases together? Does that mean that the wife caught something from the husband? That generally doesn't, it doesn't work that way with these kind of neurodegenerative diseases, you know, the way you think COVID would or some other flu-like thing. You don't just catch it from somebody. If you're just thinking about those two cases, you imagine, well, is it something in the environment, like in their home? Is it something they both, you know, were breathing or something that they ate or drank? Like, what could cause this? And it just gets weirder from there, because then you start looking at other individuals where there seems to be some kind of communicative effect with whatever this disease is. There was a, I'm just going to continue reading from that same article from The Guardian. There was a woman in her 30s who was described as nonverbal, feeding with a tube, and was experiencing drooling. And her caregiver was a young woman in her 20s, a nursing student, who also, after caring for this person, began developing some of the same things, some neurological decline that would be, again, described as similar to what her patient was experiencing. So it's just very, it's frightening. Like, imagine that, guys. Imagine if there was the fear of something like COVID, which is dangerous and deadly in some cases. Imagine if instead of it affecting your chest and, you know, your ability to breathe, it was affecting the way that your brain functioned and your ability to say words and speak sentences and understand concepts and move your body. It's terrifying. And I think that's why this case and these stories, it's being written about all across the internet. And it's also, it's something that verges on being overblown. You can overblow this very quickly because it is only 48 individuals, as I keep saying, but it is something that could potentially be worst case scenario, you know, for humanity. Right. I'm laughing because it's that scary to me.
It's a black box, right? Because it's not obeying the constraints or the behaviors of recognized conditions, right? No genetic links, possible environmental factors. And to be honest, the Canadian authorities and government made a lot of missteps here. And they're the kind of missteps that can lead people to increasingly alarmist conclusions, whether or not those conclusions are well-founded.
Agreed.
You could almost say that is another symptom of the infection, is the government not being super helpful about it, which is something anybody in a country that has been dealing with COVID, anybody in most countries dealing with COVID, can completely and unfortunately experientially understand.
It's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I guess I hear the term whistleblower and I usually think of like corporations doing bad things to people's health with their products or, you know, polluting or whatever. But I guess at the end of the day, there was a whistleblower. There was a whistleblower when COVID first became a news item. The Chinese government did try to cover it up, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. And in this case, it's just someone stepping forward and saying, hey, this is way worse than the authorities are saying, than the medical, you know, officials are saying. And we can learn that by seeing what the New Brunswick Office of the Chief Medical Officer of Health has to say, or at least that's what the office has to say. You can read New Brunswick Cluster of Neurological Syndrome of Unknown Cause. In here, you can actually get a breakdown of, you know, the people experiencing this stuff. You can read some of the findings and the response by the government. You can read through some of that. It's one of those things that when you look through it, it appears to be saying, we don't know if these people are experiencing the same things. They don't seem to be. It seems to be, you know, separate neurological disorders that are coming into play here, of varying severity. And these people don't seem to be experiencing the same thing.
Yeah.
However, this is one of the reasons that the whistleblower came forward, because there does appear to be something bigger at play here that just isn't being seen or spoken about yet, or at least taken seriously.
And the whistleblower works for a company called Vitality with a little accent over the E. Is that like a healthcare network of some kind? Or is there any relevance to the story surrounding this company and why that was mentioned in the article?
It's described as a health network. I do not know exactly what it is. I know it's one of the main authorities on healthcare within, I don't know if it's just the New Brunswick area or if it's just, you know, that particular part of Canada. I just don't have enough information on it. I apologize.
No. This is what we mean when we say things are developing, right? Because there's stuff that's still being unrolled in this, hopefully not conspiratorial tapestry. But there is one thing that really stood out to me. And at first, I didn't believe it, but I went back and read through that Guardian article, and then I went to some other Canadian-based news sources. And there's a group of scientists who are indicating that there may be an environmental culprit, like you yes. alluded to, Matt, specifically one involved in one of the big economies of New Brunswick, which is lobster, right? The lobster trade. And there's this line that I saw quoted in multiple sources, multiple reputable sources, where scientists are saying, we are ready to begin research. We are ready to do a full investigation into this so that we can interpret data and, you know, we can compare and contrast. But, quote, New Brunswick has specifically told us not to go forward with that work.
Yes.
That sounds very discordant.
Yeah, it's this is where the conspiracy stuff comes in. Because, as you stated, Ben, lobster fishing is a major thing. Imagine Maine in the United States, how big lobster fishing is as an industry there. Now, just to go a little bit northeast, you're in the same waters. It's the same deal there. And there was a study that you can actually read. It's linked to in that Guardian article that takes you to MDPI. It's a journal where you can read about neurotoxins that exist in certain aquatic food sources for humans. And specifically named in there are crustaceans like lobsters. And there was a survey of 34 of the 48 individuals who were experiencing these things. And guess what? 90% of those 34 people had been ingesting lobster.
Okay. All right. I didn't know how many guesses you got. Also, imagine Maine sounds like a great tag for a tourism
initiative.
Imagine.
Well, but here's the deal. There's no control group to compare the results of those 34 people's the survey that they took. So you can't say, well, lobster is definitely a thing, even though 90% of the people surveyed who were having these problems ate it, because I mean, maybe 90% of all people in that area, New Brunswick, eat lobster because it's part of the main, you know, it's a main industry and it's just one of the foods that's available and it's fresh and you eat it.
Right. So
there's no way to really link that unless you have a control group. And then control group, Ben, and great show. Check it out. It's still on Apple Podcasts. Mm-hmm. It's really good.
Both seasons. Thanks, man. Mm-hmm.
I was just watching, guys. I just started it, that that Netflix movie about the government's inaction when they're told that there's a planet killer event. Don't look up.
Yeah, it's a must-see.
It feels like, I've just begun it, but it feels like that kind of thing where it's a political move to allow the study of one of the main industries in your province or your area, because if something bad comes up in there, we can't sell lobster anymore. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, we have to cull a ton of the lobsters that we bring in, and we, you know, our industry begins to die. It's a political choice then, rather than a choice of healthcare and people's well-being.
Right. We get into very murky territory very quickly. We're not just talking about deep ocean fishing. We're talking about things like the concept of acceptable margins of loss, right? And then the idea that more in-depth or comprehensive studies could reveal not just the cause of 48 individual medical conditions, but it could have much larger implications for the future. You know, I think one thing we've all learned in our collective experience over the past few years is that reports of transmissible diseases are a lot like the cockroach rule in your kitchen at home. If you see one roach, then that means that there are many more that you are not seeing. And so for every one reported case, it is unfortunately safe to assume there are many more unreported cases. And that,
yeah,
it might be a powder keg politically and medically.
Dude, this, if you continue reading that one Guardian article, you get down and you start hearing quotations from people whose family members have gone through this. Some of them have passed away. And I'm going to read this one quote just really quickly. It is from a family member of someone who passed. They said, "I don't know why the province wouldn't just do the science and look. They have my dad's remains. We've given them full permission to do toxicology and what needs to be done, yet nothing has been looked at." And they just can't understand. We, you know, we made the choice to give our father's remains to you to test, to save other people, and you're not doing it. Like, why? Why are you not doing that?
And they haven't provided a reason, right? As of yet.
No, at least at the time that this article was written, I haven't seen any updates to it either. I would just say, hey, people look into this, and we don't want to be alarmist here, because again, there's a small number of people and maybe nothing, but if there's a high level of BMAA, which is the neurotoxin that has been found in fairly large amounts in some lobster in that area, people need to know. You got to think twice about what you put in your body, especially if you're feeding your child or a loved one. Like, people should be informed. And in the end, it does have major effects on an industry, or it could. But is it, I don't know. Weigh those human lives versus that, you know, that lobster money.
And it'd be interesting too, to extend this study, into lobster fisheries in Maine and in the northeastern coast of the US, including places like Rhode Island, because wildlife and infections do not practice political borders made by humans. You know what I mean? It's not, if there is something related to the lobster, which again is unproven, that is just a speculation that cannot be proven or disproven yet. If it is something to do with the environment in any way, be it lobsters or some other cause, it's not as if those lobsters are going to get to the Canadian-US border and then all of a sudden become safe. You know. Also, on a very selfish note, I got really into ordering weird seafood online during the pandemic, and I'm starting to rethink that. Also, I was ordering from sustainable places. Not to be too political about it, but the ocean is, the maritime ecosystem is collapsing. I wonder if that could be part of this as well.
Oh, Lord. Yeah, that's a whole bigger bowl of fish. Not a bowl of fish. It's a lot. That's a whole thing. Seaspiracy and all. And just to show that this has been happening for a long time, it's been reported about for a long time. Back in March of 2021, there's another Guardian article you can read titled "Mystery Brain Disorder Baffles Canadian Doctors." And it's about the same things. What is going on? Why is it happening? And how? And there were 43 cases at that time. Yeah. Look into it. maybe make your own decision really about what you think's happening, I guess. But we need to get the call out to like, let's do some testing. Even if it needs to be a third party independent group that comes in and tests the lobster, that should probably happen like last year around March.
Agreed.
Okay. Well, you're welcome for your weekly dose of happiness and positivity. Let's hear a quick word from our sponsor and get back to some more strange news.
And we're back, pivoting from a potentially terrifying health scare. Could be the new pandemic sweeping the nation. No, I don't think that's what that is, but you never know. It's good to catch these things early. To a another type of pandemic sweeping the nation, a technological pandemic called NFTs, the stupidest use of technology in the history of creation, in my opinion. Ooh, I'm sure there's some hot take.
Not if you're selling it. If you're selling it, it's great.
It's just, I don't know, to me, you know, fungible tokens or whatever are use of the cryptocurrency blockchain, or I mean, blockchain can be used for all kinds of stuff, but that's what we mainly associate it with, in order to validate unique pieces of digital art, unique digital assets of any kind. You can turn anything into an NFT. We saw you know, the head of Twitter minting the first ever tweet as an NFT. And what does it mean to own a digital asset, you might ask? Well, not much. It's literally a contract saying that you own it. But as we know, with all these stupid lazy lions and the monkeys or whatever they are, the gorillas, I guess, they're very popular. They're basically just crappy art that people pay a lot of money for in cryptocurrency, and then are able to claim ownership over these. And the minting process essentially makes it where you can unequivocally say, this is mine and I own this, but people can still screenshot them. And at the end of the day, it's just a JPEG. You can make it your profile picture, but someone else can also screenshot and make it theirs. And then there's actually been a lot of to do around that. People are like, hey man, that's mine. You don't own that. You got to take it down. I'll sue you. But it's like, yeah, good luck. And maybe there's a path to that, but it has become a bit of a emperor has no clothes kind of situation. To me, it just kind of shows the inherent hollowness and shallowness of things like art as commodities. You know, I mean, if anything, I think it's just kind of like a dystopian sci-fi way of saying, yeah, things are worth whatever we say they are. And if it's and these things aren't even cool looking, most of them. I mean, some of them are, you know, there's like Beeple or whatever, the guy that sold $1 billion NFT, which is a collection of like, you know, hundreds and hundreds of all of these digital images that he had already made publicly available on his Instagram, you know, for years. It was just like a very, very large image macro with all of these as tiny little pixels. And I think it sold for $1 billion. And so there's been this craze, people thinking, okay, NFTs are going to be the new cryptocurrency, or they are cryptocurrency in and of themselves, kind of. They're a token that you can then resell them, of course. And like cryptocurrencies, they can appreciate or depreciate in value. So it's really just opened up this kind of whole feeding frenzy around it. And it's starting to get really silly because people like, what's the guy's name that played Al on Home Improvement? Do you guys remember his name? Probably not. You probably just remember him as Al.
Not Tim Allen.
The beard. We know Tim Allen from other things like the Santa Claus, but and this guy's brother. That too. That was in a previous life. Let's give the guy a pass there, I suppose. Al was the guy who was his trusty sidekick, and he also, I think, hosted like an iteration of Family Feud for a time. He was getting into NFTs, but then he was kind of shamed for it on the internet, and he decided to not do it. Point is, it's starting to reach peak saturation, I guess, because a lot of like these boomer types are getting into it themselves, and it's starting to feel a little bit more like we're reaching the implosion point for this. But not before reality television star Stephanie Maddow decided to take the NFT market by storm. You may have read or heard that Stephanie Maddow, who is, I think she was a contestant on The Bachelor, if I'm not mistaken.
90 Day Fiancé.
Excuse me. All of those shows are interchangeable to me in my mind. I have not seen any of them between The Bachelor, The Bachelorette, 90 Day Fiancé, Temptation Island, whatever. All of those are just kind of mashed into this weird amorphous blob in my mind. And no shade to anyone that likes them. I have been forced to watch them before, and I understand the appeal. They are precision designed to keep you invested and to keep you waiting. They're just like manufactured cliffhanger after manufactured cliffhanger. I get it. It's fun. Prurient trash, and I shade on no one for enjoying these shows.
I only know about it because of an episode of My Mama Told Me, just okay. So you guys are aware.
I know about it because my pals, and you guys pals too, I think, Anna and Miles from Daily Zeitgeist have a 90 Day Fiancé podcast, which is pretty funny.
God. I believe, isn't it called like I Present You This Rose or something like that? Or
I believe that's the one. Yeah. I think, they're making an empire out of this.
That's the Rose one. See, I thought the Rose was a Bachelor thing. Are these spinoffs? Some of these are spinoffs. I think anyway. My buddy Matt Riddle, friend of the show and the network, and one of my oldest pals. His partner is a producer, I believe, on 90 Day Fiancé. In any case, Stephanie Maddow, big rising star. The problem with being a contestant on a show like that is once the show's over, you got to kind of parlay that 15 minutes of fame into something else or go back to working a regular job. And Stephanie Maddow did that with gusto. She started off doing sort of an OnlyFans type situation where people subscribe and sort of like a, Patreon kind of thing. And she was getting a lot of requests from her patrons that she consider selling her farts.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that she considers.
Did she offer a lot of toots on the show that she was on or something? Is that was she known for it?
It's a just fetish creeps. Thing, Matt. Dear just sweet creeps. Matt, oh, okay. My lovely summer child.
Like sweaty
some people are into some weird like smelling other people's farts. Or
no.
In Asia in particular, at least that's where it got its start, you may have heard of the trend of being able to buy women's used underwear in vending machines. And there was a previous iteration of that was like underage girls. And I believe, Ben, that's illegal.
Yeah, well, Japan actually just raised its age of consent, which was formerly 14.
Wow.
Yeah, but used underwear fetishization is not, I think it would be dinging our Pacific neighbors to say it was just stuck to that part of the world. The vending machine thing was real, though, from what I know. It's just no longer around now. But you can go anywhere on the internet if you are so inclined. If that bags your badgers, you can go online and find people who will gladly sell you purportedly used underwear. And if they're consenting adults, loneliness is a crazy thing. Do you?
Well, you lonely or not lonely? Do you indeed? And why the hell not? Make a little money. It's a service people want. Why shouldn't they get it? And why shouldn't you benefit for providing it? So Maddow decided, okay, did a little homework, potentially found some of the stories that we're talking about here. Maybe there's a market for this. I mean, because as we know, there's a market for just about everything. So she started farting into little cute little mason jars and bottling them up. And at first she just I'm going to do just like cut like a couple dozen of these. It's like a test. See what happens. And she did that, and they sold like hotcakes, hot fart cakes. Presumably, they're not hot anymore once they reach the recipient. But
I think they come with heating instructions, right? Reheating.
I would hope so. Yeah. I would hope so. Yeah, I mean, you got to heat them gently, lest you adulterate the pure essence that is contained within.
But she took this seriously, right? Like changed her diet and everything.
Why wouldn't she have taken it seriously, right? Because I mean, the test was a resounding success. She did a handful of these. They sold really, really well. She raised the price. I think initially they were like $50 each or something like that, and then it was like $100 each. She ended up topping out at $1,000 each for these jarred farts. And apparently, reportedly, made around $200,000 selling these.
Until,
sadly, her health began to take a turn as a result of all this farting.
Mm-hmm.
Wait. Yeah, because Ben mentioned a second ago diet that she was taking really seriously. She needed to produce only the finest farts and do so, you know, somewhat in an assembly line fashion. I mean, I don't think you or I could just summon a fart out of nowhere right now.
Unless I know person who could. It was gross. I swear to God.
You knew a friend? He could, like, was it like the fartistry technique where you sort of suck air in your butt and then you that's a trick.
It's similar, like le pétillement. The pétillement.
I would argue not a true fart. That is a false fart in my opinion.
This person, I don't know about Matt's person, but this person wasn't boofing air and then expelling it. They or at least part of the bit, because I declined to watch the entire process unclothed. Even though she and I were friends, I was like, there's a line. And, our friendship is more important to me than proving this fart thing. But it's a rare thing, right? We might have a few people in the audience today who can do that. But your point stands, I would argue, because most people who need to produce a fart, if they find themselves in that situation, do have to alter their diet because farts are a product of your gut biome, right?
That's exactly right. And Stephanie Maddow knew this. And I don't know if she had like a fart consultant or something like that, but she found a diet of, like, you know, the stuff you would imagine. I guess you don't really need a consultant. We all know what makes you fart. Things like beans and lots of fibrous foods, you know, things like that. And she was consuming so much of this that one day she woke up, I guess presumably to do her daily fart jarring, and she felt an unpleasant sensation in her abdomen, dare I say a stinging kind of like sharp shooting pain, and you know, being someone who's a bit of a health nut and very aware of her body, she went to the ER, and the doctor, she didn't immediately cop to the jarring of the farts, but she did speak to the diet, and the doctor said, hey, this is bad. This is not good for you. I don't know if it's something that was particular to her, but it was something that was causing her problems. So she had to change her business model. And guess what she changed it to?
Do you think that's real, or that's a story to make the next move make more sense?
I don't know, man. She's only, well, let's go back to that in a second, Matt.
Okay. In a second.
You know where I'm going with this, based on the preamble of this story. She decided to make the leap into NFTs, non-fungible tokens. And again, they can be many things, but they often are kind of goofy little cartoons that are, you know, unique. If you do a line of them, each one can only be owned once. That's exactly what she did. And these little cartoons are little jars with stoppers in them of varying types. Looking at some, right? You can actually go for yourself and check it out for yourself if you want
to. Good.
The website is, I'm just saying, if anybody wants to, it's sure. It's totally SF. It's SFW. Mm-hmm. It is fartjarsnft.com.
No, I'm going to correct you. It's fartjarsnift.com.
Fart jar sniffed. I'm sure that was not lost on. I mean, that's a pretty brilliant domain. I'm surprised nobody had gotten that one already. And if they did, they probably collected a pretty penny for it. But yeah, I'll bite. Fartjarsniffed.com exists, and you can go there right now. Their tagline is "Imagine the smell," because that's the best you're gonna do. Because they don't smell like anything.
It's like Imagine Maine. I brought it back.
It's just like Imagine Maine. So, by going to this website, you can take a look, browse their wares. There's one with like a little top hat. There's one where the stopper is a butt itself with a little poot air stream coming out and some of those kind of goofy emoji glasses. There's one. This guy looks crazy. He's got like a twitching eye and there's a plunger on his head. This dude here looks like he's kind of spooky. He's kind of doing these ghost fingers and there's like kind of weird, like mad scientist chemical fumes coming out of the top. That one doesn't look like it has a stopper at all. One with a donut. The list goes on, and you know, it benefits the creator or the person getting paid for these to make as many as possible. They go for about $150 in the form of a 0.05 Ethereum, because that is what you pay for NFTs with. I think if they're exclusively on the Ethereum chain. So, Matt, to answer your previous query about the narrative, whether it was true or not, I can't say for sure. But I would say that she was getting $1,000 a fart before, and now she's only getting $150 for these fake ones. Granted, you could scale these and you could do more of these, and but you might be onto something, Matt, because she is still, she hasn't completely stopped farting in jars. If you buy enough of these, there's actually there's like some benefits. You can actually get a real jarred fart if you collect a certain number of these. It's almost like getting like punch cards in your, like, you know, whatever, choose your chain restaurant location or whatever, like weed shops. Exactly. And a big thing in cryptocurrency and in different, you know, cryptocurrencies and different NFTs is what is the use case? That is a question that's always asked. Like, is a particular cryptocurrency viable? The question that's asked is, what is the use case? Is it good for, like, smart contracts? Is it good for certain types of transactions? There's, like, different ones that are built on different technology or coding or whatever that are good for different things. And sometimes whether one does better or another can depend, or if it has more, like, long-term viability, depends on the use case. So this is a great example of someone kind of understanding that and just basically bullshitting their way through it, pun absolutely intended. So utility on the website, according to fartjarsniffed.com, fart jar NFTs have four use cases that make owning them a blast. Okay, one, access to Steph for pleasure or business. Each token holder will be given access to a private Discord channel with Steph. Some of you may want to be able to communicate with her in an intimate setting, whilst others may have questions about becoming a fartrepreneur yourself. And then there are other, you know, levels, Zoom meetings. The collector with the most Fartjar NFTs week one after launch will have the opportunity to spend 30 minutes on a Zoom with Stephanie. And then it goes on to second and third most Fartjars, and the time on the Zoom diminishes. Then this one I kind of like, mentor program. Become a girl boss with access to a private group with Steph, where you can be mentored on how to build a brand, become a content creator, and become a fartrepreneur. And then four, on top of the fart-tastic use cases above, the artwork can be used as a profile picture so that you can proudly display your inclusion in the most explosive, good Lord, the fart puns never stop, community in the NFT space. Again, this is no shame. This is clever. If she makes money on this, more power to her. Absolutely. I just think it just shows how stupid and out of control this NFT space has gotten. And there's a really great article on Bitcoin.com that has some quotes from Stephanie that I think are maybe overstating the importance of this, the cultural value. I get where she's going, where she's coming from, but it almost like makes it sound like satire, and I think it diminishes what she's actually trying to say, which is this. Fart jars are all about taking ownership of your body, your inner worth, with an added whiff of creative genius. Making a statement and an impact is not about pushing a fart. It's about pushing yourself to do anything you set your mind to.
Well, I've got a lot of mason jars around the house, so I know what I'm doing. Yeah. I don't know what to say, Noel. Thank you for bringing this to our attention.
You're so welcome, guys. I'm sorry. I just think this is just such an interesting extreme, you know? And I mean, it'll probably get more extreme than this. Because you can mint anything as an NFT as long as it exists in digital form. Maybe we're looking at a future internet where smells can be transmitted digitally.
That'd be
cool and terrifying.
I don't know if you guys saw the news, but there is a
screen. Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. In Japan. Yes.
Tell me
Ben.
More. I don't know about this.
Thank you, Ben.
Story for another day, I think.
Okay. Fair enough.
That's exactly what I thought of. Wow.
Well, not much else to say, I guess. I don't know, Ben, I'm interested in particular, like your thoughts in the dystopianness of this, or if you see it that way. Like, do you feel me on the whole, like, you know, the absurdity of the art market and how, you know, like, I mean, banana taped to a wall sold for like a gazillion dollars or whatever at like Art Basel. And like, is this just kind of like a digital extension of that, and do you see it in the same satirical light that I'm seeing it in, or am I missing something, or do you see it differently?
No, I agree. Emperor has no clothes, and people, if people are consenting adults, I believe people should be able to do what they want. So they're not harming other people.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I just want to add to a lot of this stuff is, you know, devoted to people or geared towards people that have made a lot of money in the crypto space, but it's not the easiest thing in the world to convert your cryptocurrency back into, like, you know, fiat currency. I mean, it's not easy, but it takes some doing, right? So a lot of people that have like 10 Bitcoin or whatever, which is like, you know, a couple hundred, several hundred thousand dollars, if I'm not mistaken. I think a Bitcoin is like, it's dipping a little bit right now. I think it's around $50,000, $55,000, something like that. They're looking at everything not in fiat. Like, you're not looking at your, you know, your crypto wallet necessarily in how much cash it's worth all the time. You're looking at it in a different scale. So spending 0.05 Ethereum on a cartoon of a fart jar might be just the novelty that someone would just totally click instantly without giving it much thought. But then if you think about it in the real world of, like, would you drop $150 out of your bank account into a piece of digital art unless it was just super, super cool and, like, you could, like, display it in some interesting way? Probably not so much. So I think this is, like, preying on people that are listless and bored on the internet and have, like, all this kind of cryptocurrency to play with. But then again, this is also kind of playing toward these people that have very specific fetishes and very specific fetishes toward a particular talent, a particular individual. So more power to them, but also it's f-ing weird. So with that, let's take another quick break, and then we'll be back with more strange news.
We have returned for another piece of strange news. Wanted to end on this one because it is potentially life-changing for a lot of people. It's gross. It's philosophically fraught, I would say, and it's going to take us to many, many strange places. So what I'd like to do is set up, I'd like to set up some facts here, and then I'd like for us to, you know, kind of round table this. And fellow conspiracy realist, please write in about this, because we're going to ask some questions that have haunted people for a long time. But before we get to those questions, let's start with some statistics. If you have ever known someone or been related to someone who has had to have an organ transplant, you know that it is a very dangerous process, even when everything goes well. You have to find a donor. The organ, whatever it may be, has to be transported viably. There are a lot of rules and laws about the organ market. See our earlier episode and video series on the red market for our YouTube channel. Last year in the US, 41,354 US residents legally received a transplanted organ. More than half of those are kidneys, and that comes from the United Network for Organ Sharing. There is a huge shortage of organs. And a lot of people, you know, the process usually goes, unless you're rich or rich and crooked, you have to get on a waiting list for organs. And if you are on that waiting list, whatever the organ is, you're also on a ticking clock. About a dozen people on those lists for any organ die every single day just waiting. And the demand has historically outpaced the supply. Because for now, the world's not quite dystopian enough for people to be openly killed for their organs. Does it happen in some parts of the world? Yeah, kinda. And do some people who are very disadvantaged in very poor parts of the world, do they get pressured into selling their organs for peanuts? Yes, absolutely. Those conspiracies are genuine. But there may be hope. What if you went to a doctor and you needed a heart transplant and the doctor said, okay, you're not gonna, you know, you don't meet the requirements for a human heart, but maybe we can do something else. Maybe switch it up a little bit. Maybe we can give you a heart from an animal. And your doctor, in this case, it would be one Dr. Griffith, tells you, be straight with you. It's never been done this way before, but I think we can do it. What would you say? Just first off, what would you say without knowing the animal? Which you guys do, but if you didn't know the animal, what would you say?
For me, it depends on how dire the situation is, you know?
I mean,
if it was my last ditch effort at possibly surviving, yes, I make that decision. If not, I don't know. It feels like you'd wait. If there was like any light, you know, like I might get an organ transplant, maybe, and I might live to get there. Probably wouldn't do it.
Are we talking about philosophically? Are we talking about like this is super, super experimental, or does this definitely work?
You might die. You'll definitely die if you don't get a new ticker, but you might die on the operating table.
Much more likely than if you got a proper transplant.
That's the thing. It's sort of on the map of medical procedures. We're in the edge of the paper where it says, here be serpents. People weren't quite sure.
I'm just wondering if like some people might have an issue with getting like a non-human organ in their body. If they like might philosophically have some.
Constraints.
I wouldn't care. I was pretty sure it was going to work or it had a better chance of working than I had of living and the other eight transplants weren't coming. Absolutely.
Well, but this is literally a first, right?
Not quite. We're going to get into it. First of its kind. This is like the first, kind of like how the Model T is not the first car, but it's the car most people associate with the dawn of the automobile. This is in that similar situation. This Dr. Griffith, Dr. Bartley Griffith, literally said that to one David Bennett Sr. of Maryland, and the animal in question donating a heart was a pig. So luckily, Mr. Bennett did not have philosophical or religious objections, you know, like, if you are from a belief system that precludes or prohibits the consumption of pork or the consumption of animal products in general, does that violate those spiritual constraints for you to have the heart of a pig beating in your chest? This guy had a life-threatening heart disease, and in an 8-hour operation just a few days ago, he received a heart from a pig, and he is alive. The world's eyes are upon him to see how this works. People with medical experience in the crowd, or people who have lived in the world of organ transplants in the crowd, you're already rightly throwing up your hand and saying, well, what about the body's rejection rate? What about the immune response? Because the body doesn't like foreign objects impersonating body stuff. Just the same way that cops don't like people who aren't cops dressing up as cops and arresting people, right? It makes sense. And even though that's not a perfect analogy, this was not your garden variety pig. This was, as they say in Charlotte's Web, some pig. This was a pig genetically altered by a company in Virginia called Revivicor. The pig had 10 genetic modifications, and importantly, 4 of its genes were knocked out or inactivated, and one of these was a gene that encodes a molecule that causes that aggressive rejection response from humans receiving these organs. It makes it, you could argue philosophically, a bit more human. Please do check out a fantastic piece of journalism by Ronnie Karen Rabin. In a first, man receives a heart from a genetically altered pig. He is alive. This was in the New York Times, so it's not, you know, Weekly World News or something. And if he survives, and if he survives over a long period of time, this is going to be a medical breakthrough for potentially hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, but it's also going to put humanity in deep philosophical water. We will be transforming people into chimera. Chimera referring to the ancient myth of an organism that is an amalgamation of different animals. And chimera, human chimera, technically kind of exists already. There's also work, to your question, Matt, There are previous cases where people have received replacement heart valves from pigs, but never the never the whole thing. You know what I mean? Never the whole thing. This also comes on the tail of different, some real mad science. I usually dunk on people for that fatuous idea of the greater good. Greater good is a convenient rationalization for a lot of horrible things. But there had been earlier tests where they took people who were brain dead and put the medically alive, but on ventilators, and they put these hearts inside them to make sure they work before going on to someone who, you know, would have brain activity. So there has been a lot of work leading up to this, and there's a lot of work to go, but this is a game changer. Who knew pigs would be so useful? Also, it must be dangerous to be a pig now. People are using you to figure out how to breathe through their butts. They're going to grow our porcine friends as organ farms, potentially. And now the question becomes, like, to me, some of the philosophical quandaries are, is it right to do this? Many, many people would say, yes, absolutely. The life of a pig is not worth the life of a human. And already pigs are killed en masse every day to provide pork chops and bacon and so on. But there's also a ship of thesis question, right? The old thought experiment of the ship of thesis asks, if you take a ship and over time you replace it piece by piece by piece until you have ultimately replaced everything, every material on that ship, is it still the same ship? So I'm wondering if there's a world where people's organs get replaced so often that they are percentage-wise less human. You know what I mean? Where do their rights go in?
Yeah, that's a weird one, man. I can't imagine that you could... I imagine you could overwhelm the human body. And, you know, it's been... What did you say? Been 3 days or something that the guy has lived? Or 4 days or something that he's lived thus far with a pig heart inside of him?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that we know from these kinds of transplants is that it isn't necessarily something that's noticed immediately, that, you know, the body rejects something else that's inside of it. It could take a month. It could take however, you know, 25 days or something for him and the, you know, medical professionals to figure out that his body's rejecting it. I think we're in a really, like, this is really good, right? That this is happening. Until we wait this one procedure out, I don't think we can know and if other organs are going to get replaced. Ben, I want to ask you about the way that this Dr. Griffith figured out that he could transplant a pig heart, even genetically modified, into a human. Like, how did he figure that out?
There are a lot of very smart people who have been working in this field. And Dr. Griffith had some other folks working with him, like Dr. Muhammad Mohuddin, pardon me if I'm mispronouncing there, who is a professor of surgery at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. And they established what they called the cardiac xenotransplantation program, in which they successfully implanted pig hearts into baboons, about 50 baboons over a series of 5 years. So that's pretty impressive. That's 10 baboons a year getting a pig heart.
Wow.
And that's really where they kind of cut their teeth.
Is there a inherent similarity between the pig heart and the baboon heart?
There are, like, it's close enough that you could try to jury rig the system, but this is not ideal for the baboon. Goes without saying it's not super great for the pig because they're not trading hearts. And earlier, someone had tried to, in the field of xenotransplantation, someone had attempted to put a baboon heart inside of a human, and it didn't work out because of that tendency of the human body to reject these sorts of grafts. And a lot of this depends on a new experimental drug made by an outfit called Kiniksa Pharmaceuticals. This suppressed the immune system. It prevented rejection. They also used a new mechanical device to keep the pig's heart preserved. until surgery. And now, you know, pig-hearted sounds like an insult, but it may in the future just be a condition that people have. And I'm wondering how close we get to creating increasingly human-like pigs, right? Because one of the best ways outside of drugs, one of the best ways to lower the rate of rejection is to continue genetically altering the pigs. You know what I mean? Like, how close to the line do we want to get? How close should we get?
Here's a kind of a sci-fi question, I guess, to maybe introduce to this. We've talked a lot about genetically modifying pigs, and in the past, we've also talked a lot about genetically modifying humans and the societal kind of breakdown that would encompass, like in terms of like only the wealthy can afford to genetically modify themselves or their offspring in such a way as to prevent, you know, illness and things like that. I wonder if there's a way to genetically modify humans that would make them more susceptible to accepting, say, like lab-grown, you know, organ replacements and things like that.
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's not as sci-fi as it might sound at first blush. That world is on the horizon. And I would love to spend a future episode on the precipice, the bleeding edge, or the bleeding scalpel edge of organ transplantation, because it is saving lives, but it's also forcing humanity to confront questions that it just has treated as academic up to this point. We are going to wrap the show up, but I am going to end on something really cool. I'd like to give a shout out to a show that I dearly love called Radiolab. It's up there with Hidden Brain, in my opinion. And they point out, or they have an excellent episode on a tiny sugar molecule called alpha-gal, which is, despite the name, not a cool superhero from The Boys comic books. Instead, it is the sugar molecule that the genetically altered pigs don't create. And this is one of the factors that allows these pigs' organs to be accepted by human bodies. But coincidentally, how weird is this? This alpha stuff is the same thing you become allergic to after you get some certain tick bites. So one of the big questions, I want to end this way. I don't know if we should answer this. I want to end this way. Is it okay to eat the pigs after the organ transplant? If you got the pig's heart, would you eat the pig?
I think it's what they would have wanted.
We'll have to modify them to be... Well,
I don't know what they want. You got
modify them to communicate more efficiently. It's really just a matter of fixing the vocal cords, I think, and some brain centers, because they do have the intelligence of, a 3-year-old, I think, maybe higher. Well, let us know how human is too human and what does human mean in the future. We can't wait to hear from you. Stay safe out there. We want to hear your opinions on fart jars. We want to hear your take on the mysterious illness in New Brunswick. And I would really love to hear some approaches to these philosophical questions. I know your fellow listeners would love to hear them as well. So don't delay. Contact us. We try to be easy to find online.
You can find us on the internet. It's a little song era. At the handle Conspiracy Stuff, at YouTube, Facebook, where we have the Facebook group Here's Where It Gets Crazy. You can also find us on Twitter, still Conspiracy Stuff. Conspiracy Stuff Show is our handle on Instagram. And we got some pretty exciting news today on the social media front, so stay tuned for more on that soon.
Hey, and if you're like me and not a social media person, instead, go to the phone lines. When you call, please don't fart. I guess you can. I would just, you're not going to get paid for it. So jar it up instead.
What are you saying? People should only do things if they get paid for it, Matt? Sometimes you just got to fart for the joy of it, dude. Come on.
Leave yourself a cool nickname. You've got 3 minutes. Say whatever you'd like. We look forward to hearing from you. If you have other things to say, or you can't say everything you want in that 3 minutes, instead, send us a good old-fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.